I was really raised around people that use drugs. So I never looked at them no different than I would look at yourself or me.
Welcome to the Jackie Ray Show.
Welcome back to the Jackie Ray Show. I'm, of course, your host, Jackie Ray. I want to start off by giving a very sincere thank you. I am so grateful for the amount of love and support that a lot of you have poured out to me as I'm going through this professional transition. It's truly appreciated. Some of you have asked me how you can support me financially. There is a space on my website if you go to the About section at JackieRayTV.com and you can support me there. There's a place to donate via PayPal. I am going to move it to the main page because I don't feel like you should have to look for that. I'm also going to put that on my Instagram. Some of you have asked for other options. I'm going to make sure I get that done as well and let you support me because I truly appreciate it. I'm truly moving towards my independent journalist life. We are still, as a collective, though, trying to figure out a way to make sure that Long Beach doesn't become a news desert. We've seen the tweets of people saying there's so much going on in the city that we're just not hearing about. We love that as well because this is a city we love and we want to support. We want to make sure you're informed. We want to make sure you can hold politicians and city leaders accountable. We want to do all of that. So we are going to do everything we can to make sure we can do that for you. So make sure that you are supporting me on all of my platforms. You can watch this podcast on YouTube. If you're just listening to it, you can see it as well on both YouTube and Spotify. My YouTube is Jackie Ray TV. I'm Jackie Ray TV on all social platforms. When you listen to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, make sure you give me a 5-star rating. Make sure you subscribe. That will support me as well. But I do want to continue a conversation that we talked about last week when I said I was reaching out to the Black community in Long Beach to talk about what does leadership look like and do we need to do better in that. I am going to be writing an article about that. I'm going to continue to interview several people. I'm very happy that I had the opportunity to interview Pastor Pleasant. He was attacked twice. So if you go to my website, Jackie Ray TV, you can read more about his attack. But we also got a little bit off topic and he talked to me about what the Black church historically means when we're talking about the push for social justice and change. So you're going to want to make sure you stay tuned for that. But I'm also talking today to James Ellis Mark, aka Blue. He really is the epitome of what I mean when I say that representation matters, because I'm not just talking about gender and race. I'm also talking about experience. He's going to tell us about his experience going through some hard time, getting caught up in that criminal life, and how that is helping him now resonate and being able to help young kids, grown men, and everyone in between to get out of that life and get on a better path. He also started a nonprofit called Black Agency, and I just love what he's doing in the community. I'm going to make sure that I leave you all of his information at the end of the show, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But I want you to hear his story and understand why representation is so important and why leadership comes in several different forms. Take a listen. My first question is, where did the nickname Blue come from? Why do people call you Blue?
It stems from, it was an elder in our community. He's no longer with us. He's passed away a few years ago, but it was someone that he carried himself with in a militant type of way with great respect, and someone that looked out for me when I was younger. So I grew a great admiration for that older man. He was younger at the time. He was very young at the time, but he just had that aura about himself. And his name was William Bullock. He grew up here in Long Beach.
Okay. And you're from Long Beach?
Yes, ma'am. All my life.
Okay. So I saw something on your Instagram now that Beyonce got this whole country thing going on. And I saw a post on your Instagram that said that you kind of were exposed to country music in a California Youth Authority. So we're going to get to that country music in a minute, but how did you end up in the California Youth Authority?
Well, I ended up in California Youth Authority based off of the choices that I made as a youth. And because when I was growing up, we didn't have many opportunities or options growing up, you know, like the churches, like you have a lot of community-based organizations and programs now that create or have options for young men to have their doors open. But when I was younger, we didn't have any of that. So, you know, I resorted to making mistakes, and it led me first. I went to juvenile halls. I started juvenile halls about 12 years old, 13 years old. And then from there, I ended up going to camp. I went to camp twice. And then from there, I went to California Youth Authority. But just speaking realistically, it was a rites of passage. It was something that we really looked forward to doing. from my era.
You looked forward to being in that situation in your era?
It was incarceration was a rite of passage to young men coming up in the 80s, in the early 80s and mid 80s.
So that being a rite of passage, I know your mom must have known that that was something that might come. Did she ever try to instill in you, don't go that route?
Yes, and I think it was based off of that foundational setting and morals and principles that was instilled in me by my mom and my family that brought me back to where I am today. She really had no idea that I had an admiration and a love for the streets. And I don't really think it was just for the streets. I think it was just that community, part of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, the need to belong in community, just the basic needs of a human being, wanted to be acknowledged. And my mom working two jobs and working the graveyard shift. I was raised in the Carmelita's housing project, so she worked the graveyard shifts. So when she leave, I jump out the ledge and be outside hanging out with the older gentlemen, which in a way it gave me more of a leeway and more leverage with them, because I was out there at the hours that they were out there when the other kids were in the house sleep. And my aunt, she was younger, which was like, you know, she was my favorite aunt, but you could say like my best friend at the time. She'd be in the room with the door closed. She had no idea I was out roaming the streets at night. I'd be back in before my mom came home.
So how long was it before you said your mom and your family helped bring you out of that lifestyle? How long was it before you got out of that lifestyle?
Many, 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 many years. Honestly, I think I stayed in it much longer than the average person that went down that road.
Why do you think that is?
I had a fascination for it. It's like a spirit, something that takes you over. And some of us, and me, myself, I consider myself an extremist. So whatever I do, I just do over the edge, and it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I'll be a kamikaze suicide or whatever I have to do. And I just got caught up in that, and I just didn't want to let it go.
So what was the trigger? What was the light bulb that went off where you were like, this is enough, I have to turn my life around?
Well, what happened was I ended up in the drug trade, and I was in the county jail one time, and I was really raised around people that use drugs. So I never looked at them no different than I would look at yourself or me. So I had a great admiration, respect, and love for them, because they would always impart wisdom upon me. And matter of fact, they were the only reason that I got where I'm at today. Or I was able to elevate myself at the level I was, the street level per se, because of them, because I always kept them near me. Although they was older, they still gave me knowledge. And based on the mistakes that they made, they didn't want me to make those mistakes. So it was during a time I was in the county jail, and I saw one of the elders who I used to, you know, do business with in that trade. And he used to use drugs. And I just saw how depleted he was, how energetically depleted he was. But I knew his heart, and I knew who he was as a person. And so that made me take a look and say, wow, like, if I get out of here, I'll never do that again, because I started to understand the impact of what it done to our people and how it just drained them. Not only that, but my aunt was on drugs when I was very young. So me and my sister, we would be at the house babysitting her kids for her as well. So I started to pay attention to the impact that it done to her kids and things like that. But it was crazy the way I even got involved in that, because I remember young living in the projects, and so my aunt, as I said, was on drugs. And one day the doors came open, you know, in the project, we were all like family. So we kept our doors unlocked. You know, I can go spend a night over my friend's house, whatever, it was no issue. I could go, you know, their mom was our mom. And so one day the doors came open, and it was the three drug dealers and it was their two sisters. And they came in like, where they be at, referring to my auntie, but they was using the B word. And so my auntie, you know, right, at that time, people would go out in the streets and stay gone for 2 or 3 weeks, come back when it's close to the 1st or the 15th to get the check, rest up 2 or 3 days. And so they was like, where that be at? And so my aunt, she was upstairs. And so they went upstairs and started beating up my auntie. And I got up and I was trying to go upstairs, and it was me, my sister, and my baby cousin. And so the guy was like, no, sit back down, little man. So I remember hugging my sister and my cousin and saying, when I get older, no one will ever be able to do us like this. Mm. And so at this time, they walked out of our house with the iron, the food out the refrigerator, all of my auntie clothes, the television we was watching. They took everything out of our house. So prior to that, I was a young kid running around the project with me and my buddies, and we would have a cardboard box looking for other guys in the projects to break dance against. But from that point on, mm-hmm. I never went back to that. I started hanging out on the corners mm-hmm. with the older guys, drinking Silver Satin, Thunderbird, and I even started to robbing so I could be a part of them so that they could go. I'd go out and commit the little petty robberies and stuff, which progressed into other type of robberies. And so they would come back to the, and I would come back to them, and they would go, and I'd be hiding out after doing the robberies, of course, and they go and buy the alcohol and stuff. So that's pretty much, you know, how I got involved in it. And then also watching my mom and my aunts, because I grew up really around women, although my uncle raised me once I got in the streets. I saw how they struggled in the things that, you know, they were up against. So I figured that I could help them out. And that was really the main reason I got into it, was not understanding that that traumatic experience changed the trajectory of my life and the way I thought psychologically and emotionally and everything else. But as time evolved, I tried to justify it by helping my family, not only my family here in California, but also being able to be of assistance to my family in other states that were struggling.
That's interesting. So it you had a moment where you wanted to protect them, but in wanting to protect them, you ended up in the lifestyle that was jeopardizing them. That's a interesting story.
Yeah, I became from that moment. I was, my family nickname is Jamie. From that moment, I was Jamie, and I became Blue.
Gotcha. Okay. So Once you decide to walk this clean and narrow path, when did your mind kind of shift to, hey, I need to help people that might be impacted by, you know, this lifestyle the same way I was when I was young? When did that shift happen?
That happened really, really slow. And actually, like I told you, I grew up in the juvenile injustice system. So therefore, I created relationships and friendships while growing up. And I was already doing this work without knowing I was doing this work. So a lot of guys, there would be conflict and different things going on between different communities. Rather, it was between, you know, Long Beach and Compton. You walk right across the street, you're in Compton. So there would be conflict that would happen. And my situation was really unique here in Long Beach, because I was raised here in the Carmelitas, and I also was raised on the east side, central Long Beach, and I also had friends on the west side of Long Beach. So one thing I always did was my friends always were my friends, which is sometimes kind of uncommon. And when you go into the gang lifestyle, I mean, death style, it's pretty much uncommon. When you become a part of this clique, you're against everyone you grew up with. But that wasn't the case with me. I kept my friendships. So when something would happen over here or over here, someone would probably reach out to me. I'd be like, oh, I know that dude over there. You know what I mean? Let me call over there. Let me check. And so, you know, we'd be able to resolve the situation so it wouldn't, the fire wouldn't burn more intense than it had already started burning. And so I was already doing the work, not knowing it. And then there was some pastors in the community. Things would happen and people would reach out that the pastors knew. The pastor would reach out to them and they say, hey, I don't really know them dudes over there, but I know somebody over there that do. And they would come and get me. And I would step in and be like, oh, yeah, I know them dudes. I know them real good. And it'd just be a conversation based on common sense, you know, and boom, and it'd be over with. So I was already doing the work. But what really helped me to understand the depth and the brevity of this work or what I was capable of doing was a younger guy from the community. His name was Hussein Bey. They call him Maniac. He's up off the west side of Long Beach. And he told me, he said, big homie, I need you, you know, because he was already doing this work. So he was like, big homie, I need you. You know what I mean? I need you to rock and roll with me while we do this. And then so there was another elder in our community named Dr. Lydia Holly. She was connected with an elder out of Los Angeles named Dr. Akil Bashir. He runs the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute. And so they were like, when Maniac told me, I need you to connect with him because he has an 18-week intense training to teach you some things about, you know, community building. I'm like, man, I ain't tripping on that. But then when Dr. Holly said, it was kind of like the elder, it's like, I can't say no to the elder. So it was like a match made. He's telling me, she's telling me, and they don't even know each other at the time. So when I got in it, it was life-changing. I think I found everything that I had been looking for in Akil Bashir. I found a mentor. I found a positive male role model, and I've been rocking with him for 15 years now. So him just pouring into me. And then when I became a part of the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute, they had a partnership with the Chicago School of Psychology. And I was explaining to them what I told you about when the drug dealers kicked in our door when I was much younger. And so from there, the lady, she told me, she said, that was a traumatic experience. That was trauma. And that changed the whole trajectory of, you know, everything that you were. And once that aha moment came, I started to understanding like, okay. So I just felt like I was in the right place at the right time.
I have so many questions from that story. One that stands out the most is I keep hearing you refer to elders, and I absolutely love that because I was raised, have respect for your elders. Do you think now, though, some of the disconnect that we have is our young people really don't have that same mindset as far as having respect for your elders, or do you think that we still have that in our community?
I think it's been lost because what we have is we have elders and we have olders. You know, the elders are the people that you and I mm-hmm. gravitate toward, that, you know, we're in love with. But then you have the olders. And I would say that part of the situation in the Black community is based off of you have olders in leadership positions. They want to be respected as that. But then, as I said, when I was younger, none of the church doors or none of those doors was open to offer alternatives or options for young men like myself. You know, so it's like, but mm-hmm. all of the decisions and the decision makers are held with the older. So I think that there's a big gap and a big disconnect and disrespect in between. And we have to bridge that and get that back no matter what.
Mm-hmm. I like that you say that because I did a podcast not too long ago called The Conversation, and Sanai Kenfe was on there, and he said something about how the older people are kind of gatekeeping and not sharing information and not helping younger people. I think those are the olders. And I think the elders are the people that are involved and they say, hey, don't do that. Hey, I did this, you know? And so we got to maybe change the mind of the olders, maybe? Is that what you think?
Yeah, we got to change the mind, and they have to accept responsibility for being a part of everything that has happened to us. And we have to accept responsibility, of course, for our errors as well, but they have to accept the responsibility. It happened on their watch. I mean, I'll mm-hmm. give you just a quick example. Like in 1992, when we had the rebellion, which I was incarcerated at the time, but we had the rebellion. So you had young men like myself that went out there and protested against everything that we had knew, rather innately, spiritually, that something wasn't right about this system. So, you know, it came out in act of the 1992 rebellion. At that time, mm-hmm. we entrusted, I like to say, your respect, your reputation. Like, we gave our gangster to our elders and said, hey, go ahead and lead us. So what had happened mm-hmm. was they took that. And, oh, yeah, we were allowed to go to the first and the second meetings. But after that, they made the side deals and went for themselves and left us out here. And that's why, as you see, the Black agency, we created that. This came out of the George Floyd state sanctioned murder, because I feel that us as in the Black community, we lack institutions, and we lack that institution to where the framework and the body and the spirit of the elders' work and the work that we do is often lost after the moment is gone. So we have to create our mm-hmm. institutions that outlive us after we're here. And we created the Black agency here in Long Beach because it was myself and Don Mockins, because we said we have to have something tangible, something that our people can have after we're not here. So we created this mm-hmm. as a spinoff, somewhat like as the ADL, to protect Jewish people and their rights, to teach people how to advocate so that we can step up and we'll have something where people, when things are not right in our community here in the city of Long Beach, they have somewhere to go to at least be directed to where they need to be to get some type of yeah. resolve.
So you have, for people who are watching the podcast, you have your Black agency shirt on. I love that. So when was the Black agency actually founded? When did you think of the name? When was it actually founded?
It was founded the year after the George Floyd death. I'm not too.
So 2021, I think.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. And it was. It started off from there. Now we've created also the Long Beach Black Workers Center, because as you know,
okay,
when it comes to Long Beach, when it comes to, and not just Long Beach, it's just most inner cities everywhere. When it comes to the blacks, we have now become the minority of the minorities. But then when you look mm-hmm. at high school dropout rate, when you look at recidivism, when you look at deaths, and we're not just talking about proximity deaths, black on black, and you talk about all the other negative aspects on life that impacts us as well as people, the blacks in the city of Long Beach. And it's over, I don't want to be wrong, but the last 15 years, I'm certain about, we've been displaced out of this community at an alarming rate of over 10% yes. each year. That would be a crisis anywhere mm-hmm. else. So mm-hmm. And then when you look at all of the city departments and you look at representation, now if we're talking equity and then we're talking parity, we're not even there. And parity means that mm-hmm. if it's only 11% of us, 11% of us should have 11% of those jobs. We don't even have that. So we understand that at the end of the day, like it costs to fund war, it costs to fund peace. How do you create stability to people in their lives through not jobs, but careers?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the Black Workers Center came at.
Yeah. And I love that. I'm working, I'm going to be publishing a column very shortly with Anthony Holmes, and he's been constantly trying to raise awareness about the discrimination that's happening in the refuse department. And for the most part, that's been falling on deaf ears from our city leaders. And so sometimes I wonder, and this is a statement that I say a lot of times, and I know I get the side eye, but I think it's on the top five of problems that I think are in the Black community. And that's the amount of white supremacy that Black people operate in. And I don't even know if they realize that they're operating in white supremacy. You know what I mean? Like, they're operating in white supremacy. They're perpetuating bias against their own people in an effort to elevate themselves individually. Do you think that's true, or am I just reaching?
No. That's totally true. But let me say, I don't use the word white supremacy. I use the word white inferiority, because they're not supreme over us. And if you're supreme, then you don't flex it like that, you know? But yes, and again, as we talk about elders and olders, all of this has happened under the olders' watch. And then in right. this moment, as we talk about the death of George Floyd and the creation of the things that we've been able to create in the city of Long Beach, I didn't want to, again, give up our power or give up our gangster to the elders. And then I have to look back 10 years down the line and tell my kids, I said, back and was quiet, and I watched this happen, this movie, and I know how this movie is gonna end, like it has us in the condition that we're in. So I had to come out of my mm-hmm. comfort zone, which is normally myself. You see me, I'm in the corner somewhere, real quiet, like just observing, you know what I mean? Not saying anything. But mm-hmm. in those moments, I had to learn to be comfortable being uncomfortable, being vocal. And at times, right. you know, having to bring Blue out to protect James and James' future kids and the kids in this community. So at times, Blue has had to come out and reveal himself in those community settings and call out the things that have happened.
As far as like our leadership in Long Beach, when it comes to Black leadership, do you think that we're failing, or do you think we have proper leadership outside of yourself?
I think on the grassroots, we have great leadership, but in the decision-making positions, we don't have great leadership that's collective, standing on one page. It seems to be, instead of collaboration, it's competition, which it should be collaboration over right. competition. And that's by design, because you have, you know, those who want to be career politician, those who want to be career, whatever. And trust me, I get it when it comes to survival. You get these lofty positions, which is like you talk about white inferiority. They do this intentionally. You get mm-hmm. these people in the lofty positions and they get these salaries. Now they're dependent on that. And that's why I've always made sure that any position I put myself in is independent of the system. That way I can control, you know, my destiny and what I say and how I act, and there's no strings attached.
Right. No, I definitely appreciate that. So for young people in the community, or maybe families in the community, that they see their kids are on this trajectory, how can they tap in with you and maybe get some assistance to stop that from getting any further?
I mean, I'm very accessible. I work with many, many organizations inside of the community. All you have to do is just, hey, how can I get in touch with Blue? I mean, somebody will pretty much tap you into me. I work with different organizations. I work with the April Parker Foundation. I've been, last couple of years, I've been able to work with Central Child with Jessica Quintana, you know, so I've been able to just branch. I work with Pastor Woods, Success and Challenges. I work with Love Beyond Limits, Malika Chris. There's so many organizations I work. I work with Long Beach Ford, Melissa Morgan, Don Mockins. So many different people. Mm-hmm. I'm very accessible in the community. It's not hard.
As much as you don't want people to go on this road where they're, you know, in drugs and incarcerated, the fact of the matter is that it is going to happen. And to have someone like yourself in the community that went through that and is are relatable, I think that's so important. I tell people all the time, like, diversity matters, because if you can't relate to somebody, you can't really help them tell their story. You can't help them get to the next plateau in their life. So I'm so glad that you are a voice, and I'm so glad that I'm having this opportunity to get to know you more. I definitely want to work with you more. Like, if you have something that's going on in the community and you need a reporter there and you need some visual representation so we can get you more visual in the community, so people don't have to make several calls to find you, that you're just an ever present on social media. That I would love to help you do that.
Thank you so much. And I want to add that diversity is everything. And I'm going to give you an example. I was a behavioral health specialist, worked in mental health. I worked in Los Angeles County homeless and housing. I worked in so many different departments throughout the civil public service sectors. And what I discovered is that's, as we talk about racism and discrimination, I'll give you an example. When we say that we're 11 to 13% of the population here, not only in Long Beach, but Los Angeles, not only that, but throughout the nation, you say, well, dang, 11% of a population, how are we 40, I would say 30 to 40 to 50% of homelessness and all of these other disparities? Right. How is that? Now, this is where the discrimination and the diversity plays a key factor, is that when I worked inside the homeless department for LA County, I was the only Black person in that office. So now, mm-hmm. with me being the only Black person in that office, this is what I noticed. And I ran beta tests. So this is what I would do. I would go into the lobby and I would see some Black people in there, and I'd give them a little, meet me outside, you know? And I tell them, look, mm-hmm. I may not do your case management, but I need you to take my number. And I need you to befriend someone in there that's not Black. And I need you to follow them through the process of what shelter they're going to and what are the end results. Not 90 days, 6 months from now. And so what I noticed was this, is that the people who were Black, they would get sent to the shelters that didn't have any wraparound services and didn't connect them to any streets to subsidy programs or any low income housing or Section 8 vouchers. They would get sent to the shelters that they would stay in for 90 days or 6 months. Then they'd be thrown back in the streets. But the other people, they would get sent to the shelters that would connect them to the streets to subsidy voucher. What are the streets to subsidy vouchers? That mean that whatever your income is, you pay 20 to 30% of that income for 5 years. And then they'd extend it for 2 years. And then possibly after that 5 years, you could get a Section 8 voucher or a low income voucher. They were all like 80% of the time getting connected to those programs. But the Blacks, 98% of the times, they were getting sent to the shelters, kicked back in the streets. But guess what? The people who serviced them, they weren't my color or your color. So that's where the racism kicked in at. And the diversity is so important, because I made sure that the people that came before me that were Black, no matter what color they were, if you're in a dire situation, I'm going to help you out. But I most definitely made sure that the Black people, that they got connected to a shelter or to a program, that right after they left that program, they could be connected to something that would create stable and permanent housing for them with Section 8 or something like that. But I was the only person there. And then so after doing that for so long and so many months and keeping my data, I called it out on the whole office. I called it out. I said, hey, this is what's happening. This is why LA County, more Blacks out there, because this is what y'all are doing. How do I know? And I just told them what I just told you.
And what did they say? How did they respond to that?
They were shook up. They was like Elvis, all shook up.
Were they shook up?
Were they shook up because you brought it to their attention, or were they shook up because they were pretending like they didn't know this was actually happening?
Both.
Okay. Because they were definitely pretending. That's not something that you need to, that's very in your face.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But then mm-hmm. again, now let me give you this. When you have these young sisters and brothers and they go to these different organizations or these different programs, county, whatever you have, and they're very, very upset. Now I see why they're upset, because I had people would say, hey, I tell them, hey, fill out an intake and somebody's going to call you in 3 days. They say, I did that 3 times last year and nothing happened. Mm. I'm still homeless. You see what I'm saying? So when they're coming into these situations, they've already seen what they're going to do. So that's why.
I want to say thank you so much to Blue for stopping by the show. He dropped us so many nuggets, so many areas that we can potentially reach out and do better as a community. I'm going to make sure, especially if you have a young person that you want them to talk to him specifically, I'm going to leave all of his information in the description so you can come back and reference that whenever you need. Make sure you stay tuned, because next week I have someone else that's going to speak to leadership. And make sure you subscribe to my website, JackieRayTV.com, because I'm going to continue this topic and I'm going to continue to bring you as much news as I can about Long Beach and the surrounding county. So if you're in Inglewood, Compton, Carson, wherever, please hit me up. You can email me directly at JackieRayMedia@gmail.com. I will respond as quickly as I can. And thank you again for your support. It has warmed my heart so much, and I needed it because I was stressed, y'all. But we are still working for you. We are still behind the scenes loving on Long Beach, and that will never stop. So remember, life is hard. Try to make it good.